So good afternoon. Anyone from the VA out here? Oh, good, a few people. So it's interesting, as I've heard these other presentations, to consider outside of the VA system, which I've been in for the last 3 years, some of the barriers that have been addressed, and then for your consideration that have exist and have been addressed, and for your consideration what may happen and what it looks like in a single payer system, and how we have moved forward. So I did label myself as a health services researcher, but with I have a strong clinical background and have done some implementation work really in delivering a lot of chronic disease care. So and based on this project that I'm going to describe to you, a national level project, I was asked to work for the chief consultant for primary care and assist in our national adoption of the patient-centered medical home project. I'm not certain how many people are aware, but the VA has adopted this in a very big scale way with learning sessions, learning collaboratives, demonstration labs, millions of dollars. And you may see intermittently that I'll use the word their patient-aligned care team. Probably about a few months ago, patients were perceiving the patient-centered medical home as that implied for patients that we were going to go into their home and provide, a couple nods in the audience, care for them. And so for those reasons, we changed to the National Patient-Aligned Care Team. So it's PACT with an exclamation point. So I'll try to stick with patient-centered medical home, as that's, I think, the terminology that most people are familiar with. So I was part of a work group, and I have no disclosures, a work group that wanted to look at best practices for diabetes care with the National Program Director for Diabetes, Dr. Len Pogash. And we wanted to look at this, and we were commissioned by the Chief Consultant for Primary Care and VA and Central Office to look at this, because it affects almost 25% of our patients have a diagnosis of diabetes. And in such a large integrated healthcare system, we thought that covers, and the numbers have increased since that 5.5 million up to probably almost 7 million patients. This was a 2008 data that we had looked at. We provide primary care at sites at more than 750 sites, and predominantly in our system, the primary care for diabetes is predominantly provided in primary care. About 85% of our diabetes care is in our primary care clinics. So we wanted to look at the quality of care and then try to do a deeper dive into what was happening and what are things associated with high-performing practices, recognizing that there's a lot of contextual component to that, but in an effort to then share across sites, which is one of the Secretary's transformational initiatives put out for the Veterans Health Administration in the spring. So we looked really predominantly at the outpatient diabetes clinics. And this started with a group of primary care physician leaders in May of 2009, where we met as a group. There were about 40 of us, and we identified goals and the way that we would proceed from that point in time. And then in September of 2009, we formed groups and worked on identification of really best practices both in and outside of the VA, so that we really did an in-depth literature search to look for what was considered to be best practices inside the United States and outside of the United States. And from that, we came up with a detailed interview guide, and at the same time, I obtained some funding from the Diabetes Query. So we wanted to look at the interview guide and performed interviews, and we'll describe that in the following slides. So we use the Diabetes Cube. It is an administrative database of every patient who has an ICD-9 diagnosis of diabetes or who has glucose more than 126 milligrams per deciliter as a diagnosis on more than one occasion. And we looked at the administrative database that contained more than, had 140 facilities and 582 where we deliver a bulk of our primary care, which is in community-based outpatient clinics. So we wanted to stratify patients into performance, and the most available data that we had was from 2008, and it did have every diabetic patient in our system, and we looked at facilities at the network or regional level, at the clinic level, and then in the even larger regional level, and ranked them according to glycosylated hemoglobin A1C more than 9%. We then also considered two subpopulations that we thought had particular relevance to the Veterans Health Administration, which are the serious mentally ill patients, and looked at and thought about the recognized disparity that exists in those patients and their chronic disease care. So I wanted to particularly look at that cohort, as well as patients that were receiving a prescription for insulin, as I believe that's a marker for more severe or longer disease duration. So we developed a 59-item interview guide based on the elements of the chronic care model and also based on the patient-centered medical home attributes. And we then used a propulsive sample and categorized, according to sites, patient sites into high, middle, and low performers. And we then looked at a representative sample of the different strata, paying attention specifically to this concept of positive deviance. So when we ranked all of the facilities and looked at them according to percent of patients with hemoglobin A1C more than 9%, we looked for specifically and interviewed one facility where their region was not performing well and was in a low-performing region, but that facility had figured out how to be successful in that, even given the surrounding and the context of a lower-performing facility. So I did all but one of the interviews concomitantly with a PhD qualitative researcher, and along on the line with me, we interviewed physician leaders at those sites, as well as nursing managers or some pharmacy leaders at those clinic sites for primary care. And we classified the content into themes. And then I also specifically, interestingly, looked at components of the chronic care model and if we could associate more elements of the chronic care model use with the higher performers. And we have the advantage of having a completely electronic health record for the last 10 years. So I think that really puts a number of people into the very strong side for the clinical information system. This is a newer model on the right from McCall Institute, where the bottom is the incorporation of patient-centered medical home concepts into the chronic care model. So what did we find? So from a quantitative standpoint, we looked at a shy of 3 million patients. Women, as you probably recognize, was a very small percentage of patients. And you can see on the right-hand side that predominantly our patients fall between 55 and 74 years of age. And that, in general, patients, sites that did well with general group of patients with diabetes did well also with those seriously mentally ill, as well as the insulin users. This is to show that, again, if you performed well at the community-based outpatient clinic level, you also performed well at the facility level and also at the regional level, which is where what we call VISN, and it's a breakdown of the different users. And so what do we find qualitatively? Because I really found this to be the most telling and the most rich component. And I felt as though the interviews were between 30 minutes and an hour, and I had some appreciation of the sites based on those interviews and what they were facing. So not that surprisingly, low-performing sites had a lack of teamwork, and between nurses and physicians. So even in a single payer system, nurses, you know, it was very variable how much the nurses and pharmacists were coordinating care with the primary care providers. And higher volume of patients, high homeless volume, and in the bigger cities, there was associated with lower performance. So what about middle performing sites? When I interviewed them in general, they talked about individual patient barriers, less about system barriers. So I think that the lower performing sites really gave some credence to system barriers and staff. And higher performing sites used things like telehealth, validated non-face-to-face visits, used a lot of shared vision and team responsibilities, and a lot of coordination, even within our electronic health record, for coordinating the care for patients. We, again, because of our electronic health record, we have the ability to build locally a lot of disease-specific registries, and that's what was happening. Patients would get letters that would be sent out on the right side of the chronic care model that would be electronically triggered when they weren't at the goal, that would be ask them to come in and electronically capture when their next appointment was. So letters could be automatically sent out without really much human input that would initiate those laboratory values prior to the next primary care provider or next pharmacist or nurse visit. So it really was a lot of care coordination, and there was a lot of really interesting innovation in terms of the homeless clinics and trying to get at a lot of that population, which I could talk more about afterward. I know I'm running low on time. This is a visual depiction of what I think that we found. Not surprisingly, low performers, there was not that team sport, which I think we need in chronic disease, which I know that we need to do chronic disease care well. And as you moved to the middle performers, there was a lot of creativity and a lot of innovation trying to figure out in their local context, how can I make this work? But they weren't exactly sure how to get there. And the highest performers had leadership support and said, you have an idea about how to make things better? Go ahead and try it. So I think that we have to recognize in this evaluation that there is really quite a lot of variation. It was a little bit surprising to me. And that the higher performers really, when I looked at it, did use more of the elements of the chronic care model and more elements of patient-centered medical home. So there's really no shortage of innovation, and sharing across sites really must be a part of our plans. So best practices were identified, and the bottom, which is patient-centered medical home, or PACT, I'm involved in implementing the learning sessions. There's going to be 6 learning sessions. And it's in the Institute for Healthcare Improvement format, where we're trying to identify the innovators and the people that the teams that have been really successful in trying to spread that throughout the rest of the region, which is how the learning collaboratives have been put together. So that's it, and I appreciate your time and willingness to listen and how the VA is moving forward with patient-centered medical home and PACT.
Okay, I want to thank all of our presenters today, and now we'll just open the floor up to questions for anybody.
Catalysts, the populations that your projects offered services for, or that you evaluated, the majority of folks were high-risk Medicaid, right? And we know that at least 50% of the Medicaid population has challenges with substance abuse and mental health. And we know that the folks that are in substance abuse and taking medications for mental health, that affects their physical health care. So I'm just wondering, in your projects, really there's not time for the answer, if you would consider going back to your home base and talking to them about including substance use and mental health in the program model or in the evaluation model, so that you get a complete picture of cost effectiveness of these designs. I mean, the folk person you did with your piece, you talked about a little bit about community engagement and some alternative ways of giving outreach to folks. So I just feel like we're just skimming the surface and we're doing it in a way that's just really focusing on a very narrow, important, but narrow set of medical indicators when the population is has challenges that are much bigger.
You know, you make an excellent point, because that one parent that I talked about that had brought her child to the hospital 52 times for was a mother who had mental illness and had some compliance issues. And I think, you know, when you look at pediatric healthcare issues, obviously you've got to consider the context of the family. So you make an excellent point. Thank you. I also wanted to go into it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to say that also in our group of patients who were picked because they were high cost and high risk, there was a very large proportion of patients with psychiatric conditions.
So was the intervention that you measured or part of the model, was that an effective psychiatric condition intervention? You know, that's kind of the question we're asking, right?
So and the VA has done quite a lot of work. Talked to you afterward about the innovation related to mental health patients with diabetes.
Challenging. Our primary care providers are also very, very busy, and they have a huge patient load. The providers that we work with, I think they're unique in that they're willing to put in their extra time. So they're actually working beyond their clinic requirements for their workday to get this in. Now, whether this is something that can be rolled out on a larger scale, and whether it can be sustainable to a larger group, we haven't been able to collect that data so far. We're still evaluating just among our providers how much time it takes for them to do a little bit extra. We're hoping, our goal is to create a mechanism for some financial incentives of payment reform so that when they do manage these patients with a little bit more complex issues, that they'll be able to be compensated for that.
So to follow up for that, for the productivity expectation, is there a difference between those who are champions for rheumatology condition versus those who are not champions? Now, it seems that they're referring to those champions.
We haven't done those evaluations. One of my big pushes for this program is to collect more data and to look at our results more carefully. The way the program was developed was, it sounds like a good idea, it sounds practical, let's get it started. But I think to really, really capitalize on the potential of it, we really do need to demonstrate these results.
Gordy, do you want to ask something?
So many things with each group.
You only get two.
I was actually most engaged by the specialty referral in the LA County also. And actually, it sounds like you're underselling it, but I was actually going to overplay it. I mean, in terms of how powerful it is to be able to create those linkages and pull patients in instead of a push system with barriers. So, you know, hopefully the data you're looking for will be there. I guess the diabetes thing, one thing I want to raise is this question. It seemed like there was very little variation from the high sites to the low sites. That slide was just up briefly for the VA system.
Oh, for the, yeah.
So I wonder what that means. It seems to me that rather than looking for the outliers and learning from them, you sort of need a whole new system approach. And I guess one question I have, which seems to be a powerful barrier for me as a clinician trying to give diabetes care, is point of care A1C testing. So is that something you've looked at? In other words, if you can see their result today, you know whether to intensify their therapy versus this whole thing about you have to send them out and call them back.
So interestingly, for mental health patients, when they show up to mental health clinic to try to capture them, we are doing point of care testing for that. But if you really look at the evidence-based recommendations, and I was part of the VA Department of Defense diabetes guidelines that just got released in July, which are probably some of the most evidence-based, it's not really, you know, a great test. There's just a the coefficient of variation is very high with the point of care testing. I guess you're right, it's better than none. So if it's 12, you know to intensify therapy. But you know, I can't underscore for non-VA folks enough the role of a system approach of other healthcare providers. I understand, you know, trying to think about that in a payment system, but we've been successful across the VA because we've had nurses and pharmacists and teams to try to help support the primary providers. I don't know if that's helpful at all.
I was just wondering, you know, it's patient-centered, and the patients have a choice to not participate, and what would be done with those patients? You know, I'm a nurse and I do health promotion, and one thing I've learned in all these years is I can talk forever to people. If they don't want to do it, I'm going to get nowhere. So it seems like the outcomes would be better if you have people that truly want to do something, you know, with their health. So
then the next question.
I work for the DOD Army, and we're trying to do the medical model, but I have lots of people that don't want to lose weight or give up smoking.
Right.
All those things would impact on the outcomes.
Right.
I think we haven't looked at that enough, the patient preferences and patient engagement. And for the VA, I know for the DOD as well, for trying to provide education materials to help move people and activate people.